Hello, welcome to 8.9 Newsweek. I'm Finlow Castain. What exactly do the Soil Association mean by a worm hunt? And why do they want us to dance for these wriggly ecosystem warriors? Can venture capital really help to scale the transition to regenerative agriculture? And why has deer management become such a divisive issue in Scotland? Well, that's later, but first, the latest UK peatland code revision is now open for consultation. I spoke to Dr. Renee Kirkfleet-Hermans, the peatland code coordinator for the IUCN UK Peatland Programme, and I started by asking her why so much UK peatland has become a carbon source rather than a carbon sink.
So peatlands are indeed generally in a healthy state, are a really, really good carbon sink. But back in the days, we thought our peatlands were wasteland. So we've tried to make use of them, and to make use of them, we've tried to drain them. Because peatlands are naturally waterlogged and really wet and soggy soil. So it's not really you cannot grow plants on it. You cannot grow a crop on it. So we've tried to drain them and make use out of them. Not very successful in a lot of places. And that meant that as soon as you drain your peatland, you get oxygen to your peat layer that decomposes your plant material that was locked in there, so your carbon that was locked in there, and then it comes out as CO2. So then they become a carbon source. Overgrazing is also a part of it, and generally just air pollution as well. So there's all these human aspects have resulted in degrading of our peatlands in the UK.
Do peatlands naturally dry out, or is this always a response to human activity?
That's a good question. It's generally in 99% of places in the UK is down to human activities. Obviously, climate change means some areas of the UK are becoming drier. And we see that especially degraded peatlands are a lot more in trouble if you do get a drier climate, and healthy peatlands are more resilient to that. But we don't really know what would have happened if we didn't degrade them. So if maybe in some places those peatlands would have degraded naturally, or as much as you can call climate change naturally, because obviously we've done that, we are doing that to the planet as well. But yeah, it could have an impact in some areas in the UK.
So if water is the key element, then what are the chief ways that peatland can be restored?
So the key thing you need to do is get your water table back up. So if you've dug drains to them, it's blocking those drains. If you've created bare peat, or if there is now bare peat, is getting vegetation back on that peat, so to lock that back in so you cannot wash it away or cannot be blown away. And then there's something we call reprofiling. So if there is like really steep slopes of like sometimes like we call them hacks and gullies. So it's kind of, it looks like a natural, but it's not natural, but it looks like a natural gully through a peatland, and it can have quite steep slopes. So by reprofiling, that slope is then reduced, and it means your peatlands can actually, restore itself after that. So you're getting, the main thing is getting water back into it.
And what sort of infrastructure is needed for that? How do you achieve that rewetting?
So we try to use as few external resources as possible. So dams for drains are quite often dug by peat. So they use deep, really good peat is like impenetrable. So they use that to block those dams. Sometimes we need more leaky dams. So sometimes wood is used, or stone is sometimes used. So it kind of depends. Ideally, they use peat to block the drains, but it depends on if it's good enough peat to be able to do that.
So let's come to the UK Peatland Code. What's its purpose in all of this?
Yeah, so the UK Peatland Code is created and managed by us and the IUCN UK Peatland Programme. And it's there to get private finance into peatland restoration. So we know that it's not enough public funding committed to actually restore all of these peatlands. So if we just would rely on public funding to get our peatlands back to a healthy state, we're waiting for a very long time. So we need other finances into peatland restoration. And through the Peatland Code, that's one mechanism for that. So through the Peatland Code, you can get, as a landowner, you can get carbon credits. And those carbon credits can then be sold to end buyers, so to companies who can then use them as an offset. And that's the way to get to pay for your restoration and also your ongoing management and maintenance of those sites.
And how significant a role does peatland restoration play in terms of the UK's overall natural capital marketplace?
Yeah, it's growing. So the major player, like the main one, is still at the moment woodlands planting. So tree planting is the main natural capital element in the UK at the moment. But we are growing. So we are growing quite significantly every year. And like I just said, there's a lot of peatland that needs to be restored. So there's a big opportunity to grow as well.
So the Peatland Code is a mechanism that underpins private investment into peatland restoration. But is the market busier in any particular part of the UK?
I don't think the market is busier in an area of the UK, but we do have more projects on the ground in Scotland. So Scotland has about 80 to 90% of projects at the moment, but our projects also in England, Wales and Northern Ireland. But yeah, most projects in Scotland, and that's to do with most of our peaters in Scotland. So that's the first one. But also it's to do with how the public funding works in Scotland. So there is, under the Peatland Code, we allow the blending of private and public finance. So in Scotland, there is Peatland Action, so that's a public funder. And we've worked really hard with Peatland Action to align the Peatland Code and Peatland Action. So you do a lot of the information gathered works for both. So there are other reasons, but those are the main two reasons.
Now, the latest revision of the Peatland Code is out for consultation. Who's it aimed at? Who do you want to respond? And what's the purpose of the consultation?
Indeed, version 2.1 is out for public consultation, and that's really to gather feedback on any of the changes we are proposing to make. So there's no big methodological changes in this version. It's really updated guidance. There's a grouping element proposed for the first time on a Peatland Code, for example. So it's really aimed at people that are wanting to use the Peatland Code, are currently using the Peatland Code, or maybe are not using it because there is something that doesn't work for them. So we've got specific questions in a consultation, but there's also an open question for any other feedback. So yeah, if it's basically, we would like to get as much feedback as possible to make it as good as we can and as useful, because our goal is to get these peatlands restored.
That was Dr. Renee Kirkvliet-Hermans from the IUCN UK Peatland Programme. The Soil Association is calling on families to practice what they're calling the ancient art of worm charming for soil health throughout the month of May. I spoke to Alex Burton, the head of worms at the Soil Association, and I asked him to tell me more.
Absolutely, yes. So the worm hunt, our sort of worm charming project, is a citizen science experiment, really. To try to understand the health of Britain's soil through counting worms. The healthier the soil is, the more worms there are, is sort of the general rule. And we know that farmers will count worms on their farms as part of their testing, but we really want sort of families and children to get involved in learning about the health of our soils, to understand where their food comes from. And so that's why we're asking people to get involved. We've got lots of information on our website, including a worm hunt guide, which will help people to know exactly what to do and what to do with the data once they've counted all their worms, to let us know.
Fantastic. Now, you've called worm charming an ancient art. Is it actually?
It's a bit of both, really. So it's all of the techniques that we're telling people to do are really inspired by what nature does. So you know, you will often see a seagull in a park, perhaps sort of tapping its feet on the ground. What it's doing there is introducing some vibrations to try and bring the worms up to the surface because they might think it's raining. So we ask families to do all sorts of things, from stamping on the ground to twanging with garden forks. And on the fun side of things, you know, there's people who've done our sort of hunts before where they've used tubers and opera singing and all sorts of things just to try to get the worms out of the ground. So it's really, really fun, but very much inspired by nature.
And how long does it take for the worms to come up? If I was twanging my garden fork, would I need to wait for an hour, or do they come up quite quickly?
It's amazing, actually. Sometimes they come out of the ground like anything, you wouldn't believe. But for the purposes of the sort of experiment controls, we ask families to do it for half an hour. So half an hour of chaos and then count all the worms and pick them up as they come, keep them in sort of the dark and all of that. But yeah, about half an hour is the general rule.
Now, worms really are a keystone species in the soil. What can they tell us about soil health?
Oh, all sorts, really. But, you know, I mean, the number is the main thing, really. But they're sort of playing a really, really vital role in keeping the soils healthy. They're recycling the nutrients through the soil. They're improving the soil structure, not just through their sort of burrowing activity, but through sort of helping to bind soil together with the mucus that they're producing. And they're repairing damaged soil all the time. So and sort of breaking it down so that, you know, other sort of organisms can process it. So playing a really important role there.
Now, how can people tell if their soil is healthy or at least healthier than somebody else's? How many worms should people be finding?
It's really difficult to say actually on that, because all sorts of other environmental things play a role in how many worms you might expect to find. And so what we're sort of suggesting really is, you know, if someone was to do a worm hunt this year and count the worms, when they take part in the worm hunt the following year, they'll be able to see whether or not they've been able to increase the number or decrease it. If they do a hunt and find not many worms at all, there's loads of things that they can do to help improve the soil at home. So, you know, from letting their grass grow longer or introducing more soil-friendly plants. So it's a really nice way for people, I suppose, to be able to track the health of their gardens and green spaces throughout the year, just a really fun and silly way.
You've talked about lawns there, but are there particular places in people's homes and green spaces where they're more likely to find worms?
I mean, a compost heap is always a fantastic place to find worms. That's often where you'll find the brandling worms and that sort of thing. So that's a great place to do a hunt, really.
And if people taking part really aren't finding many worms at all, are there ways that you can recommend to increase worm numbers in their gardens?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, ultimately, the main thing we sort of suggest is just to be a bit messier. You know, I think that the Brits especially are a bit too tidy in their gardens. And, you know, the more room there is for biodiversity, the more ground cover there is, the healthier the soil is going to be. And we often find on farms that are in conversion to organic systems, when the fields are sort of in their recovery period, there's not many worms. And then once we've sort of managed to get them further down the process and they're in organic, there's loads. And so create the right conditions and the worms they'll come. Yeah.
That was Alex Burton, Chief of the Worms at the Soil Association. Pelican Ag is a venture capital company that specialises in scaling regenerative agriculture and rebalancing food supply chains to improve ecological and nutritional outcomes and food provenance. Simon Evill is a founding partner of Pelican Ag, and I started by asking him to explain exactly what venture capital is.
Venture capital is a very specific form of finance intended to fund an extremely high-risk company that also has a high potential. And it typically funds early stage innovations, very young companies with a handful of people involved in them who need quite a substantial amount of capital to fund them through to profitability and further growth. And there are different types of venture investors that focus on particular stages of company, particular innovations and geographies, but that's the general gist.
And with venture capital, because it's high risk, what is the attractiveness of this particular kind of investment?
The returns can be very high. I mean, to give an example, one of the early investors in LinkedIn realized a 50x return. Now, that's an exceptional case. But generally speaking, venture investors are looking for companies that can return the portfolio. So if they invest in 10 or 20, 30 or 40 companies, depending upon the risk positions that they've taken, the stakes that they've taken, and how they've allocated that capital, because bear in mind, you can hold some of that capital back and then invest it in further rounds. So you can double or quadruple down into the companies that are doing well within your portfolio. There's a way of, there's a playbook, if you like, and various strategies that venture investors use to try and achieve high returns for their investors. But the capital is locked up for a considerable period of time, you know, typically speaking between 5 and 10, sometimes longer amount of years. And so it's an asset class. But it's one of many. And in the investment world, generally speaking, venture is a tiny slice of people's investment portfolios, but it fulfills a role because it's there to back innovations within the economy.
How can this sort of investment help to scale regenerative agriculture?
Indirectly, I think, is probably the fairest way to put it. So regenerative agriculture in and of itself is a movement of farmers and actors within the supply chain and other people involved in food and farming. It's a movement of changing management practices. And on a deeper level, it's a mindset shift in the way that human beings approach land management and their relationship with nature. So obliquely, technology, let's put it this way. Up until fairly recently, we've developed technology with a reductionist mindset. We've developed technology for addressing symptoms and making our lives easier in every aspect of our economy, and food and farming has been no different. And synthetic agriculture, chemical fertilizers, pesticides, fungicides, large tractors, plowage, tillage equipment fall into that category. We're now entering a different phase where humans have the potential to develop technology for regenerative outcomes, technology which lends itself to people and communities and individual farmers and land stewards managing land towards ecosystem health and better profits and a more healthy rural community. And that's what we're trying to tap into. That's what we're trying to invest into, is the technologies that help that.
So give us some examples. What sort of projects are you funding at the moment?
We've just invested in a soil lab analysis technology called Miraterra, a Canadian company. It's a Raman spectroscopy device, a high-powered resolution device that looks at soil soils that are coming into the lab for analysis and is able to perform a rapid set of analyses, which are being done in a fairly analog and human-intensive way at the moment. So it's offering a potential step change in the way that soil labs analyze and process soils that are coming into their laboratory. And we think that that is going to be very important for speeding up, for example, how soil health is done at scale across the world.
And is the no-fence collar part of your portfolio as well?
Yes, that was our second investment into no-fence. Yes, we've taken a bullish view on the potential of rotational and managed grazing. It's a movement. It might be a marginal part of the livestock management industry, but it's growing very rapidly. It started, as you know, many, many, many years ago, but it has trade-offs, and it's a labor-intensive operation, particularly moving mobile fences around landscapes. So depending upon a farmer's setup, depending upon your hedgerows or your perimeter fence, you know, there are many cases in which using a virtual fence, which is what NoFence have developed, is hugely advantageous. One area where it's very, very helpful is grazing through woodlands, where it's just totally impractical. And in some cases, you're not allowed to put fencing in there, and you wouldn't want to put fencing in there anyway, because it's a habitat that you want wild animals to access. NoFence is one of the leading virtual fencing companies in the world, and we see huge potential in that as a tool to help farmers who are already on the path towards rotational or more advanced regenerative grazing strategies.
Now, we've discussed the way that venture capital is high risk, but how do you decide which projects you're going to invest in?
Well, in a very pithy sense, both Chris and I, the founders of Pelican Egg, we come from impact investing backgrounds. So we come with a set of, skills and sort of protocols that lend themselves to analyzing companies with essentially two lenses, if you like, the impact lens and the financial return and business potential dimensions to a company. We've been massively inspired by studying regenerative agriculture, and we've taken elements of regenerative design and management into our diligence process. And I think that's been very, very useful. So, you know, without giving a huge amount of way, we're trying to look at the problems holistically and analyze companies holistically and make decisions on that basis. I think the more interesting dimension to taking regeneration as a philosophy and as a set of management systems into venture capital is to figure out the best ways to help the companies we invest into and the portfolio to achieve the outcomes that we all want to see, a transformed landscape in the UK, but also globally, and to start to fight back against challenges such as climate change, soil erosion, and the poor nutritional quality of our food, etc.
And do you think that there are particular barriers to attracting more venture capital into the regenerative farming space?
Yes, I mean, it's highly sort of nuanced. So on one level, there is a great deal of capital out in the world that is seeking impact as well as financial returns. However, the road of good intention, or the path to hell, is paved with good intentions. So an awful lot of capital has gone into solutions which, I guess, from our perspective, are not necessarily going to be very effective, or at worst, are going to generate huge unintended consequences. There's been a huge amount of capital in our space that has gone into novel foods and into vertical farming and other strategies which don't deal with the root cause of the issue. They don't help farmers manage their land better. They don't deal with the poor nutritional quality of the food that we're eating globally, or its lack of diversity, or the fragility of the food system, the fact that it's so centralized that it sort of is creaking at the seams. So we've been on a long journey to educate other venture investors and other institutional investors that would invest into our fund, so that they can understand better the potential and the inherent logic of the regenerative food and farming movement, and why it's such a vital area that is just massively underfunded. And it's at the moment, regeneration is underfunded at the venture capital level, but as you know, it's underfunded across the board, whether that's banks providing loans to farmers, or whether that's critical pieces of infrastructure like small abattoirs. That would dramatically help or local food supply chains that would dramatically help us to deal with some of these sort of multifaceted challenges.
Simon Evell from Pelican Ag. Many rural businesses in Scotland have become concerned by a Scottish Government proposal to substantially increase deer culling using deer management nature restoration orders. The issue has become increasingly divisive, and now deer management industry groups are working together trying to find a more collaborative approach. I spoke to Tom Turnbull, chair of the Association of Deer Management Groups, and I asked him what's wrong with the Scottish Government's proposals.
I think the proposals for deer management nature restoration orders in particular provide quite a lot of concern for the industry and the people managing deer on the ground. There's a lack of information as to how they might work and how they'd be applied and over what sort of area. And whilst we understand that restoration and enhancement of habitats are, it's important, it's also quite subjective as well, and can be a very, very slow process, particularly in the Highlands. Over a number of years. And I think because of that, it doesn't take into consideration the importance of socioeconomics and those people employed in deer management on the ground and how their livelihoods are going to be sustained if deer levels are reduced beyond a certain threshold. So I think it's really important that Scottish Government takes the industry with them. And this feels quite a lot like statutory deer management, when we would absolutely prefer to be on the sort of voluntary principle ourselves.
Just looking at the top level of this, the Scottish Government says that improving our natural environment and tackling the climate crisis through tree planting, woodland regeneration and peatland restoration would not be possible without effective deer management. Do you agree or disagree with that as a statement?
And I completely agree that effective deer management is vital to all of the above. Tree planting, and regeneration, peatland restoration all need deer numbers below a certain level. And it's also vital that those deer management jobs in remote rural areas are sustained. I think what isn't recognised enough is the amount of private funding that goes into deer management currently. I think it's currently underfunded, deer management, particularly when you consider alternative management opportunities like agriculture or forestry. I think the funding for deer management is almost nil. And I think there's also a lack of recognition of what's already taken place in the Highlands in particular. And the Highlands are the only area, probably of the whole UK, where deer numbers are actually declining. And this was evidenced by Nature Scot in their 2019 report. But we are aware of the, what the deer population is. We are working to reduce it. And I think it would be good for Scottish Government to recognise that more often than is currently the case.
In terms of what's happening now and the fear that you have surrounding deer management nature restoration orders, what's the big change that you would expect to take place?
Well, from the consultation, it's very unclear to us how they will be imposed and over what scale. And if you take it in conjunction with the biodiversity strategy that's also announced, priority woodlands, for example, you'd have to reduce deer numbers down to below 2 deer per square kilometre. And that could have significant impacts for a lot of rural businesses. Whilst we understand it's important to protect trees, and we're very much in favour of that, there's a whole suite of things that should be considered, not just shooting deer, but other things as well.
So is the fear about a blanket approach that fails to take account of local circumstances?
I think it's absolutely vital that you look at the nuances of the landscape that you're working in. What works in the highlands is not going to necessarily work in the lowlands. And even within the highlands, what might work on the west coast is not going to necessarily work in the Angus Glens. And restoration and enhancement are potentially going to be very quick in some areas and potentially might take 30, 40, 50 years in others.
Now, the Association of Deer Management Groups is working as part of an industry-led initiative called the Common Ground Forum. What's the aim of the forum?
Historically, the deer management sector has been quite there's been a lot of views, a lot of strongly held views and a lot of opposing views. And the Common Ground Forum is a network of individuals from across Scotland's largely upland deer management sector. And we've committed to work together to sort of have a collaborative approach and to find where we do have common ground and where we can work together rather than concentrating too much on the things that we might disagree on. Let's work together where we can is the plan.
Now, your association, along with other key stakeholders, recently called on the Scottish Government to introduce a venison subsidy. And it seems that in this regard, at least the government has listened and agreed to a national rollout of the Cairngorms Deer Pilot Scheme. Could you just talk to us about the Cairngorms Pilot, about how it works and whether you think a national rollout will indeed be a game changer?
Well, I think it's important, as we've already mentioned, that, you know, differing areas might need a different approach. An incentive scheme in the lowlands would need to be potentially very different. You're talking about different species for starters that you're managing. But in the Cairngorms, I think that the colours, the incentive is based on your 3-year average hind cull. So it's based on the female cull, which is all important. And it's based on setting each landholding a target of 110% of that average. So once you are above, you achieve that 100%, 110% cull, then you're going to be paid £70 per carcass for each red hind calf above 85% of their 3-year average. So it's trying to take culls up and rewarding people for doing so. And I think the receipts will be collected by the game dealers, so there'll be the game dealers will be keeping tabs on carcasses, so you know exactly what's being taken. But I think it should be promoted, and I think there is conversation of other schemes, one in the lowlands and one potentially for seeker deer, which seem to be increasing in parts of the highlands as well.
And why is a subsidy important in the first place?
Well, in the uplands and in the lowlands, deer management's undertaken at a loss. So every time you go out and every carcass that you bring in, you're making a loss on effectively. So if you can offset that loss with a subsidised price or a subsidy coming in, then that would, I think, help people to undertake a higher cull than they currently are doing, because some or a lot of places currently rely on a sporting cull as well. And I think it would also allay some of the fears in the industry that people have for deer management jobs as well. If there is some funding coming in to offset any losses that might be coming on down the line in the sort of sporting sector as well.
Now, because the issue of deer management has become so divisive, what do you think needs to happen next? Is it Scottish Government's responsibility to take some of the heat out of the situation?
I think it's, I think actually because of the Common Ground Forum, actually there's probably less heat in the industry than there has been for some time. And Scottish Government have been supportive of the Common Ground Forum. And we work closely with Nature Scott on it in particular. I think my fear is with the introduction of deer management nature restoration orders, we could see a lot of the heat coming back into the discussion. And just at a time when in many ways, we're getting on better as an industry than we ever have before. Heavy-handed implementation of legislation by Scottish Government may well bring in heat at a time when we're actually starting to really achieve things in the deer management sector.
So at this stage, you want the government to demonstrate that it's listened and to come back with a solution that's genuinely workable.
I think it has to be. I think it has to be workable. It has to be relatively straightforward for people to enter into. And I think it needs to be flexible across Scotland as to how it's introduced and for what species and for what sort of landscape they're looking at. It cannot be a one-size-fits-all approach.
That was Tom Turnbull from the Association of Deer Management Groups. And that's the end of the programme. Thank you to all my guests. I hope you've enjoyed the conversations. And if you have, please take a moment to share the podcast and do get in touch if you've got news to share. Our Newsweek podcast brings together a collection of the audio from recent 8.9 video interviews. And if you want to watch instead of listen, then please visit our website at 8.9.com and click on the TV tab. More as ever on our website, where you can also sign up for our weekly newsletter. I've been Finlow Castain. Bye for now.